Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Because you know that where you choose to live affects so many different parts of your life. So, not to mention Apartments.com has custom search tools. So if you're looking for something specific like pet friendly or commute friendly, or if you're looking for three different bathrooms to go to in your apartment, you can find it on Apartments.com. And with Apartments.com, what you see is what you rent. They comb through their listings to make sure all of the information is verified and up to date so you're not getting scammed. That way, you're not wasting your sweet, sweet time. They're making hunting for a new place a breeze. So send subpar rental searches packing and visit apartments.com to find your perfect place. Apartments.com, change your apartment and change the world.
Southern California is home to millions of drivers, so the open road is rarely open. And unfortunately, as we all know, a lot of drivers aren't always focused on navigating the street in front of them. So Toyota is doing its part to help make driving safer. Toyota Safety Sense is a no-cost suite of safety features designed to be a kind of safety co-pilot, and it comes standard on most of their models. Find out what Toyota Safety Sense is all about. Visit buyatoyota.com. Your Southern California Toyota dealers make it easy. Toyota, let's go places.
The first degree.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
And I remember looking back and him staring and a strange interaction, but I just kept going. You know, you think, oh, what a weirdo. You know, strange glance back at him and he definitely, you know, he was a strange looking character.
Hey guys, welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Fanick. I'm sitting across from Alexis Linkletter and next to Billy Jensen. Did you like that intro?
That was wonderful. It sounded a little bit like the Jetsons, so I'm good with that, yeah.
Oh, I didn't even mean to.
Yeah, well, you know what? That's something that I had to live with. That was a cross I had to bear as a kid.
I had to bear.
Having a name that sounded like the Jetsons, but you know what? Mid-century modern space age architecture, I'm all about it.
I like a futuristic mid-century modern vibe.
Yeah.
That's really for me.
I'm all about it. So,
by the way, just in case you guys have been living under a rock, we hit 10,000 on Instagram, which means we opened our merch store. And I have to say, our merch f***ing rocks.
You did kill it.
I think I killed it.
You know what? Jack is the queen of merch. I don't know if you know anything about Jack, but Jack started merch at, what, 16 on the Warped Tour?
It was like 19.
All right. Yeah. But the merch is so good. I love the comic thing that says the first degree on it. I love the
Stranger Thing font.
The Stranger Things
sweatshirt.
Font.
You're welcome.
Alexis
Linkletter must be stopped.
Alexis Linkletter must be stopped.
I wonder if anybody will buy that.
I'm going to buy
that. Has no one bought it?
No.
Really?
Oh. You know what? Our best sellers, if ever anybody wants to go on and like if they're wondering what's selling good, the Smokey the Bear t-shirt is killing
really?
It.
Really?
Also, Talk Murder to Me, the one that you're like, you should move that off the front page.
It's I didn't say you
the
should.
The pink Talk Murder to Me sweatshirt. It's like super cutesy.
Number one, right?
Number one seller.
And the anxiety mug I saw was doing pretty well.
Yeah. So you guys go get your first degree merch. It's pretty f***ing cool.
By the way, only you can prevent serial killers with Smokey the Bear was my idea.
So. The bear was not the quote.
Yes, it was.
The quote was my idea.
The quote was literally Billy.
It was Dean Navarro's idea.
It was.
Listen, no, Billy is just a poor man's Dave Navarro. It's so sad.
But much taller.
He's like a stretched out version of Dave Navarro.
Dave Navarro Gumby.
In the world, Gumby. Okay.
Anywho.
Anyways, I'll what day is it, Billy?
There's a lot to choose from today.
There are July 3rd might be my favorite holiday.
The dayest day there ever
was. It's the
was.
Dayest day ever. What's your fave?
It's American Redneck Day.
It is.
Ooh. It's Happy Disobedience Day.
That's my favorite.
It's Happy National Compliment Your Mirror Day.
Which, who the fuck made that up?
Maybe it's look at yourself and compliment yourself.
I think that's
what it is. Compliment your mirror.
But this is the one that speaks to me. It's National Stay Out of the Sun Day. And that's what I have done my entire life.
That's all. It made me think of Jared, too.
Really?
Because he burns.
I stay out of the sun when, you know, I grew up on Long Island. When anybody was, hey, we're going to the beach, I'd be like, no, I'm going to stay in my room, watch Bob Ross and...
Bob Ross?
Yeah.
What beach did you go to on Long Island?
I went to Jones Beach.
I went to Robert Moses.
Yeah, of course you did, because you're a rich kid. So.
That's rude. That's rude.
Are we going to talk about Harry Potter for a second?
We do need to talk about Harry Potter.
I was having happy hour with my mom yesterday, and we were just talking about Harry Potter or whatever. And I'm like, you know what? I think Jared's a Hufflepuff. But I just assumed he is, because he exudes Hufflepuff like energy.
The word sounds like him.
Yeah. It's like, oh, it's so nice.
Like a Jigglypuff, like a Pokemon.
Yeah. So I texted him, and I'm like, what Harry Potter house are you? Hogwarts house. And so he took the BuzzFeed test, which is like a bullshitty whatever test. And he's like, it's Hufflepuff. He's like, this. I'm doing the real the Pottermore one.
The Pottermore one.
And sign your soul away.
Yes. And the Pottermore one is J.K. Rowling's site. It's official.
She created it herself. So anyways, he took it again and got Hufflepuff. He's pissed about it. But then now he's like sending me all these articles. Or no, you sent the article about why Hufflepuffs are amazing to love.
Yes. Harry Potter, there is a article, when you become a Hufflepuff, they're just like, oh no, wait a minute. We want to make you feel good about being a Hufflepuff.
Yeah.
So there's an article called Why You Should Fall in Love with a Hufflepuff.
You should, though. Hufflepuffs are probably the best people to fall in love with.
Yes, because they won't. One of the things is...
They won't leave you?
Hufflepuffs won't turn into a dark wizard after a bad breakup, and I think that's probably the best one. So I said, all right, well, what are the... I know I'm a Ravenclaw. I've taken the test before. Ravenclaw is kind of the witty slash smart slash weird kids, because Luna Lovegood is my absolute favorite character on Harry Potter. What else? What's Jack? What's Alexis? And I thought Jack was probably Gryffindor, and I thought Alexis was Slytherin. Yeah.
If I see Harry Potter and take the test, maybe well, I will
see,
be.
Alexis's problem is, like, okay, on the BuzzFeed quiz, the questions are more general. They're like, what's your, like, what do you like to do for fun? But the Pottermore quiz is like,
you
what's
Harry
your
Potter.
Patronus?
And Alexis and I'm just like, this sounds like a good word.
Oh, that's right. It's just like, what's your...
Which of these animals would you choose as a pet? I'm like,
and there's like 15...
Shriek owl. Dragon toad. I'm like, dragon toad. But I have no idea what they are.
Right.
Well, yeah.
So I'll, by next week, I'll watch Harry Potter this weekend.
Well, there's a lot.
I don't think... Yeah. All right. Well, you... So here's what happened. Jack took the test. She's a Gryffindor.
I knew I was.
We knew she'd be a Gryffindor.
Yeah.
Alexis took the test. She's also a Gryffindor.
But she also was answering a bunch of questions.
I was like, a white owl sounds pretty. And I chose that. All right. So I'll watch them and then I'll do it again.
We'll update next week on what house Alexis is in. And honestly, everybody, go back and take the test. It's fun.
It's fun.
I love her. J.K. Rowling for life.
Love her.
Love you.
Okay. Well, that's enough of that. So let's turn down the lights.
And turn up your anxiety.
Because this could be you.
The state troopers were sure he wanted to get caught. First, he made sure there were no license plates on his 1984 Mazda pickup truck. Then he tried to lose them in what can only be described as a slow speed chase, never exceeding 50 miles per hour on the Southern State Parkway during the 20-minute pursuit. It was around 3:30 a.m., and the driver ignored all their attempts to pull him over. He exited the parkway and continued on Wantagh Ave north, and then onto Old Country Road west. The male driver finally obliged by crashing into a utility pole in Mineola, Long Island. The troopers pulled the 34-year-old landscaper out of the truck and handcuffed him. One trooper noticed a terrible odor and flashed their light onto the blue tarp in the bed of the Mazda pickup. The other trooper rolled it back and made a horrifying discovery. "I killed her," he said. The gray-eyed confessed killer would later confess to 16 more victims. he picked them all up on his drives through the region. He said he had sex with them first and then killed them. By the end of that day in 1993, the troopers began to suspect that they had accidentally stumbled upon one of the biggest serial killers active in the history of New York, Joel David Rifkin.
Police started locating Rifkin's victims one by one, steadily, one shovel dig at a time. They unearthed the terrible story of Rifkin's passion. How? Why? The only way to answer these questions, like we always say, is to start at the beginning.
All right, you guys. So today's first degree, his name is Paul Ragazzino. His daughter, Allie, is a listener. We are not going to hear from him until a little bit later in the episode, but hang tight. It is just because this case in particular is so robust. Most people didn't know they were connected to Joel Rifkin until he was arrested.
All right. So Joel Rifkin's birth mother was a 20-year-old college student, and his biological father was a 24-year-old college student and Army veteran. And at only 3 weeks old, he was adopted by an upper-middle-class Long Island couple, the Rifkins. The adoption was completed on February 14th, Valentine's Day of 1959. They were overjoyed at the successful adoption and named their new son, Joel David Rifkin. And then 3 years later in 1962, the Rifkins also adopted a baby girl and named her Jane, and they raised Joel and Jane and loved them like they were their own.
So the Rifkins moved to East Meadow when Joel was only 3 years old. And when we started this podcast, Jack had a first degree.
Mm-hmm.
Alexis had a first degree. And they kept asking me, do you have a first degree? And I didn't. This is probably the closest to a first degree that I've had. And there's a lot of things that pop up because he literally lived and worked just a mile away from me.
And this is when you were also living there.
Yes. So we're going to take you back to, so he goes to East Meadow High School. So now I have a story about East Meadow High School. In 1962, a kid was throwing spitballs in the cafeteria and he got in trouble for it. And they told him to move to another table with the older girls. And he's got to stick with the older girls for the rest of the year. And he keeps on asking this girl, are you going to finish that? Are you going to finish that every day? Like, are you going to finish that meal? He ends up marrying that girl. And that was my dad and that was my mom. So this was what was going on at East Meadow High School. It was this wholesome post-war suburbs that you hear about.
Mm-hmm. That's a really cute story.
And, that is a really cute story.
And I basically grew up in East Meadow. So Joel moved around through his childhood years, and we're going to tell you these stories not to make anyone feel bad for him. Now, there's no excuse for what he did, obviously, but you know, this is the story. This is actually what happened.
Well, and you want to know how an animal became an animal,
right?
That's why we give the background. It's like, what little threads did this guy follow to mm-hmm. become the monster he became? And it's just a little insight.
And I have to say, so I was doing a lot of research, listening to other podcasts, watching other documentaries about Joel Rifkin. And like we're saying, this is not an excuse. This doesn't justify anything that he has done. But it is interesting listening to other podcasts because we're going to talk about bullying, right? And a lot of these other people that are talking about his story are kind of blaming his behavior on bullying. And there are so many people in the history of this, of humanity, everybody's gotten bullied, some people terribly bullied, and they have not turned into serial killers. So it's not like a cause and effect kind of thing, but it's funny because other people have explained it kind of in that way.
Absolutely.
So going back, Joel Rifkin, he was excluded from team sports when he was younger and neighborhood games, and he ended up being the butt of every prank and sadistic joke. Bullies assaulted him in school, they pulled his pants down, they stole his lunch and his books, and they harassed him constantly. And as far as high school was concerned for Joel, he couldn't get a prom date and he was nicknamed Turtle by his high school mates. And this nickname came from his slouching posture and slow gait. His parents were oblivious to his torment by his peers. His mother later said, quote, I thought of him as a loner, and it fully didn't come home to me what was happening until later. He was an academic failure, suffering from undiagnosed dyslexia, despite having tested an IQ of 128. And he became what was essentially a mediocre student in a family full of intellectuals and an agricultural college dropout with an adoptive dad who was a vice president of the school board.
Yeah, and I remember actually going to the East Middle Public Library, which is a better library than the Westbury Public Library. And I remember taking out a bunch of books about Son of Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading these books. This is me at, you know, however old. Reading these books about Son of Sam in the East Middle Public Library, and I actually looked up at the sign above me, and the sign said the Ben Rifkin Reading Room, which was his dad.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So after he passed, they named the library after him.
Yeah, yes.
Because he was so beloved.
He was right? So, yeah, exactly. So this was a guy that was all about education, and his son wasn't so much about education.
Interesting. So he did end up sharing two hobbies with his mom, which were gardening and photography. And the two were often seen gardening together. And I did read that throughout his kind of upbringing and his youth, he was very interested in making the front of his house like the best on the block with the best plants and the best flowers and like very concerned about appearance.
I read that too, where it's like they lived on like a quarter acre corner lot and he was
constantly like tending.
Pruning.
Yeah,
exactly. It's really interesting. So Joel's poor grades and his bad skills with sports embarrass his father, like Billy said. I mean, this guy was an intellectual. And their relationship was slightly strained as a result. And like most fathers, his dad was hoping to be able to teach his son about sports. He tried teaching me about football, Rifkin later said, which was his sport in high school. And Rifkin said, I couldn't catch the thing. And after a year or two, he got extremely frustrated. That was that. No more football. Things went from bad to worse at East Meadow High School. Because besides actually having the good grades, Joel was a stereotypical nerd. Glasses, high water pants, white socks. I don't think nerd is a thing anymore, but
that's now a hipster.
Now I'm like, that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, sounds hot.
To me, and I just think nerds, the smart people, I mean, I guess he wasn't
smart. He was probably like a quote-unquote nerd.
He was an outcast.
Greece.
He was a miss,
like,
yeah, he was an
like
outcast.
Eugene in Greece.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So one of the bullies who harassed him later called him an abuse unit. He was subtly obnoxious, like a presence that just annoyed you.
So Joel eventually joined track. And in an effort to fit in, he was rewarded the nickname Lardass. Teammates hid his clothes and they shoved his head into the toilet. But instead of fighting back, Joel invited them to watch TV and drink beer at his house, thinking that he's like extending some sort of an olive branch. The guys would come over and watch TV and drink his beer, but it didn't help making him any actual friends. One of the quote-unquote friends said, we used him, to be blunt about it. He was just really easy to make fun of. So Joel was an obvious failure in athletics, and he eventually joined the yearbook staff. And he, after joining, promptly had his camera stolen. But undeterred, he slaved to put the senior yearbook out, but he was excluded from the year-end wrap party. His mom said that he was, quote, absolutely devastated. And in his teens, he developed a passion for cars and trucks. He started tinkering with carburetors, which is somewhat of a normal activity. And he also fell into the AV crowd, where he would help with microphone equipment and run projectors during assemblies. So he's just trying things out.
Just trying it out. Just trying to fit
trying
in.
Trying to figure out where he fits in.
High school's tough.
High school
f***ing
sucks.
And like hearing about bullying, it all looks different. I mean, I was popular in high school, but bullied mercilessly. Where literally, I was a virgin. In girls spray painted slut on my car.
Oh, same. I mean, not
with
same.
With spray
exactly,
paint.
But.
And then I had to drive home and explain this to my parents. And it's like, then they're worried about, it's bullying. It all looks different, but it's terrible.
Well, it's vicious.
Brutal.
And it's brutal. And sadly, it does happen to most people.
It's so terrible. It's so terrible. Didn't hurt anyone, though, as a result.
That's what I'm saying.
So, the same year Joel joined track, he immediately began exploring his curiosity about sex workers. And he started trolling for women in nearby Hempstead, Long Island. According to Robert Mladenich, who wrote the book on Rifkin, Joel's fantasies included some bondage, some rape, plus a gladiator-type thing with two girls that would fight to the death. In some daydreams, he raped and stabbed women, but his fantasy victims were silent, just very passive about it.
Then apparently after he watches Alfred Hitchcock's movie Frenzy, which was loosely based on the Jack the Ripper homicides in London, and his fantasies and fetishes started to become based around strangling sex workers. Real-life romance was not in the cards for Rifkin for the most part. So he did get at least one high school date. And the interest was actually killed after she witnessed fellow track team members trapping him at a gym and throwing eggs at him, which made Joel actually call his father for help. And then another time, he goes out with a girl to a pizza parlor, and the same bullies chase him out of the pizza parlor, and then he has to run to safety, they both do, to a public library.
There were, however, some people who didn't notice the social ineptitude of Joel. A former classmate named Alan Whitlock, who graduated with him from East Meadow High School in 1977, described his friend as, quote, very intelligent. He said that Joel was very quiet, enjoyed listening to Zeppelin and the Eagles. And a neighbor named Joy Ryder said that Joel was the kind of guy who was a gentle person, one who would help her bring her packages into the house.
Joel graduated near the bottom of his class in 1977. He looked forward to college and adulthood. Life could only get better, right? But the worst for Joel Rifkin was yet to come.
So Rifkin's first attempt at a college education took him to Nassau Community College, but he ended up getting pretty bored and restless there. He didn't take any of it seriously, and he cut classes habitually. Somehow, he transferred to the State University at Brockport, a Rochester suburb, in the fall of 1978. But before leaving for his first semester, he thought that he would maybe fit in better if he lost his virginity, so he headed into Manhattan and picked up a sex worker for $20. She was in her 30s and quote-unquote played teacher with him, and he finally felt like he was in power for the first time in his life.
While in college, he seemed to enjoy the photography club, but succumbed overall to his usual lackluster academic performance. And all the while, in the background, Rifkin had dark fantasies brewing.
So the only real girlfriend of his life was in Brockport, but the relationship went nowhere. And she later said that Joel was, quote, sweet, but always depressed. So he comes back from Brockport. He moves it back in with his parents. And he starts working a string of odd jobs around Long Island. And they're all pretty short term. Former employers describe him as having poor hygiene, chronic tardiness, and he just doesn't care about the work. He's not a dream employer. He worked at a local music store, which is called Record World, which is actually my local Record World, which is where I would go to get records. And his boss there described him as, and his boss actually called into a local radio station afterwards. He described him as a total piece of work. This guy couldn't even count to 10. And it's even been said, though not confirmed, that he worked at the store at the same time as a very famous producer of probably the greatest radio show of all time. But we'll get to that and all the other pop culture aspects of this case later on. Then he actually goes to work after the record store at Coronet Toy Store in Westbury. Now, as a kid, this was actually my main toy store. This was the toy store that my mother took me to because it was only, it was right down the street. This was my toy store, and I probably dealt with this guy. And, you know, Joel, he dreamed of becoming a famous writer, and he wrote some pretty bleak poetry, and I searched for some of it, but I couldn't find it. But all the while, through all of this, he maintained an interest in two things, which is photography and horticulture, but both of them, he couldn't make them pay.
As his childhood friends left the suburban block for college, professions, and families of their own, he was a self-employed landscaper who strived to keep his family's garden among the proudest and prettiest in the neighborhood, as Jack said earlier.
So he seems like he's really on the path to darkness, but the next moment really pushes him up a few steps. So in 1986, Rifkin's father, who was a heavy smoker, and he already had emphysema, he falls chronically ill. So his dad was diagnosed with prostate cancer in the fall of 86, and he became incredibly weak from the pain by February 87. So he wrote a suicide note, he took a massive dose of barbiturates, and he dropped into a coma. And he was in the coma for 4 days, then he died.
So later that year in 87, Joel Rifkin was arrested for the first time in his life for soliciting sex from an undercover policewoman. But he escaped with a nominal fine. But instead of the incident keeping him away from soliciting further interactions, rather patronizing is what he used to call it, instead that incident kind of drew him to the world even closer. And that close call really seemed to intensify Joel's budding deviance, and his fantasies about murdering women began to fester.
Joel's final attempt at a college degree included a 1988 enrollment in a 2-year horticulture program at the State College of Technology in Farmingdale, New York. And for the very first time in his life, he made straight A's for 2 consecutive semesters. He was offered an internship at the prestigious Planting Fields Arboretum in Oyster Bay, New York. The appointment was an honor, an unexpected bonus for him, and certainly the most accolades that he'd ever received in his life. And there, Joel found himself very attracted to one of the other interns, a pretty blonde girl, but while he shadowed her at every opportunity, he never found the nerve to ask her out. Instead, he concocted something in his head, an elaborate fantasy affair, and he was beyond frustrated when she failed to reciprocate his secret passion. And after years of failure, a lack of ambition, a lack of self-care or pride, Joel was finally ready to succumb to the vileness of the person that he truly was. So after years of pent-up anger and self-induced failure and humiliation, he craved a release that would allow him to feel like he had power over something, over anything. And it was at this point that Rifkin reached his demarcation point.
So sex workers who had encountered Rifkin in the past described him as having nails that were earth black. His pickup truck was filthy. His words were seldom, and his sexual abilities were quite limited. One woman he'd gone on a date with named Karen said, "He seemed to me like he was a mama's boy." Karen and Rifkin had gone out 4 times. Another sex worker named Renee started crying when she saw a picture of Rifkin's face on the TV. Renee had last seen Rifkin 3 months ago. A $40 trick turned into an abandoned parking spot between 57th and 58th Street. Rifkin wanted a half and half, market slang for a mixture of vaginal and oral sex. His only other request was that she not speak. How much, he would ask. But then he'd never argue over the price.
One sex worker named Michelle said that she had been approached for sex by Rifkin once, but she turned him down. She later said that he didn't seem like the type who would hurt anybody. Another woman who encountered him, named Charlotte Webb, survived 2 different encounters with him. The 27-year-old said that he picked her up in Lower Manhattan in April of 1993, 2 months before he was caught, and paid her $40 for sex. She said, quote, "Some guys get rough, but I never had an inkling with him. He was just a mellow, nerdy guy. We talked about photography. He said he could get me a discount on a camera." Joel told her his name was Jimmy and that he was going through a divorce and struggling to support 2 kids in college. And she said, quote, "He seemed lonely, like me. I told him, well, now you have a friend."
It's sad to not be able to see, like, the monster in front of you.
A
Attention, Bachelor Nation. Off the Vine with Caitlin Bristow is coming at you 3 times a week on Podcast One. Pour yourself a glass of wine and hear Caitlin play games and chat it up with some of the biggest names in Bachelor Nation and beyond. Download new episodes of Off the Vine every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Tiffany Bresciani was a 22-year-old woman from Louisiana, and she came to New York to make good. She wanted to be a singer or an actress. Now, Tiffany had a boyfriend named Dave Rubenstein, and Rubenstein was the singer and co-founder of the New York-based hardcore band Reagan Youth. Both of the lovers were addicted to drugs. And now, punk bands typically don't pay the bills, and Tiffany supported their drug habit with sex work. Tiffany would work with a customer, Dave would wait outside, then they would meet back up and then go buy drugs. On June 24th, 1993, Dave and Tiffany were cruising Allen Street when a familiar customer pulled up. Tiffany got into a Toyota Camry and told Dave that she would be back in 20 minutes for a quick $20 payoff. But she never came back. When Joel Rifkin started having sex with Tiffany, the backseat of his mother's Toyota, he put his hands around her neck and started strangling her. He then said that he stared at her for a long time.
Tiffany was dead. And back in Louisiana, where she was from, her mother and her grandmother anxiously waited for a call from her. And earlier that day, they'd mailed a care package to her filled with summer dresses, pictures, and a teddy bear. Tiffany's grandmother had a nickname for her, which was Little Lamb. And Dave called the police for the description of the truck and went to the club where Tiffany danced and basically checked out all the hospital emergency rooms in the city searching for her. And it hit him hard. A week after he learned Tiffany was dead, Dave Rubenstein died by suicide. And this is something I was thinking about as we were doing the research, and people liken him to other killers who target sex workers. Mm-hmm. And basically, they put him in this category and they're like, he targeted prostitutes. And I just think it's a way of, it does not honor the suffering. It really just dumbs down what he, dumbs down isn't the word, but I hate that they categorize him that way.
No, absolutely. And because it's technically correct, because these women are definitely in a job as a sex worker that is perilous, that they would get into a car of a stranger, which leaves them open to danger. But just calling them a sex worker, or calling them, which is what they called them back then, a prostitute, is bullshit. That doesn't define who Tiffany was. That doesn't define who any of these people were. She was a 22-year-old woman who was loved. And whenever they use that term, and remember, and we've run into this, both me and Alexis have run into this when we've worked on stories for television, and it turns out the victim might be a sex worker, and the powers that be will say, no, we don't want to do the story because it's a sex worker. And that's crap.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
You know what? A lot of jobs have high risk. For example, show I'm working on now, the show down the table for me, all of them worked on Deadliest Catch. And, like, lots of people die on those boats. Mm-hmm. And they're not shamed about it.
No.
Like, jobs have high risk. But for some reason,
well, it's
only
sexism, isn't it?
Of course. That's where I was going, where it's literally just women.
Yeah.
It's either if you have any risk at your job, you're an irresponsible mother. You don't care about your kids if you have any risk. Or you are a sex worker and they dehumanize you. But men could be firefighters and not come home to their kids and no one gives a shit.
Part of the reason why he kept going after sex workers is he's like, wow, I'm getting away with it because nobody seems to care.
Nobody misses them.
And nobody misses them, which is false, because obviously all of these women had families and friends that missed them. It's not like they went missing and nobody batted an eye. Like, they had families that were fighting to try to find them. So that is just either the media or society, like, twisting things, and it's not fair.
Or him justifying his behavior, grasping at straws to do so.
Right.
You know, But he's a narcissist. Anyone who can take a life and justify it is, it's for his pleasure, is the bottom line.
Absolutely.
But yeah, back to what we were talking about. I mean, Tiffany was loved. Her family sending her care packages. She had a boyfriend. I mean, they were struggling with addiction. Doesn't make her less loved.
Doesn't make her less human either.
That's right. Here's Joel Rifkin in his own words talking a little bit about his encounter with Tiffany on that night.
There are good nights with prostitutes and there are bad nights with prostitutes. There are times you get ripped off. There are times things go as planned.
There's a lot of self-lying. It was almost an addiction seeing these women. Initially, the self-lie was that if I do something horrible or just corrupt this whole thing in a large way, that I could stop going.
She was the third or fourth girl I was with that night. In the back seat of the car, strangled her.
After he stole Tiffany's life, he started his mom's Toyota and headed back towards his mom's home in East Meadow. He stopped in Levittown to buy a tarp and yards of heavy cord, and he later wrapped the body in a blue tarp and put her body in the trunk of his car. And Joel had just arrived home when his mother demanded the car keys to go on a 30-minute shopping trip.
Drove her home. Mom could have put groceries in the trunk that morning. None of it made sense by that time.
So Tiffany's body was still in the trunk, but Joel didn't have any time to move it. His mother just drove around for a half an hour and never knew. And relieved by his little, quote, anxiety attack, Joel moved Tiffany's body into his cluttered garage.
So he leaves Tiffany's body in this wheelbarrow in the garage for 2 days. And the summer heat's pounding down. And he starts to get worried about leaving her there. It's a bad idea. So June on Long Island, the body is going to decompose really rapidly. It's very humid. And he's also worried about the blood that he'd gotten on his mother's upholstery. But it wouldn't really matter in the long run because he'd get arrested and the truth would be revealed before she would ever notice any of those red stains in her car.
Then, just after 2 a.m. on June 28th, he placed Tiffany's body in the back of his pickup truck, let the truck roll down the driveway so he wouldn't wake up his mother, and headed off towards Republic Airport in Farmingdale, where he planned to dispose of Tiffany's body. And at around 2 a.m. on Monday, June 28th, 1993, Rifkin swabbed his nose with Noxzema so that he could tolerate the pungent odor coming from the corpse in the back of his truck. That's when he was pulled over and arrested. One of the detectives asked him if there were other victims, and he didn't answer. They asked more than 10, more than 20, and he said, 1 or 100, it doesn't make any difference. But the detective questioning Joel kept pushing and said, you want these people to have a proper burial, don't you? And soon, Rifkin started coming around to the idea. So at the beginning of the night of Joel Rifkin's arrest, Tiffany was number one. But by the end, Tiffany would be number 17.
Troopers discovered that there was the body of a female, a white female, in the back of the pickup.
I was under arrest. I don't know. I knew that was it.
You do it, Joel. What do you have to say? What do you have to say, Joel?
One of the earlier homicides or nights or events might have been euphoric, and then I was chasing it after that. The thing is, you never get that original rush. That's the whole point of why you keep chasing it.
You know, and he later said that his arrest was the result of a 25-cent mistake, which is that missing license plate.
The media descended upon what would be the most prolific serial killer case in New York State since Arthur Shawcross. And it was in the midst of this media coverage that our first degree Paul realized the significance of the encounter he had had just months earlier. And this really is a fascinating story that demonstrates how connected we truly are and how connected even just by one degree of separation, strangers who Rifkin to a victim would also be connected. in This Is So, whether we like it or not.
As the type of job we have working for the power company, you encounter everything. There was something in the news the other day, and I saw the police car blocking the road, and I looked down the street and I saw an emergency services truck parked in front of the house. Wouldn't you know, News 12, a woman strangled her mother to death right in Brentwood, down the road from where I work. With this job, I said to my daughter, I said, we see everything. I've walked on Jerry Seinfeld's property. I've seen some of the most beautiful homes on Long Island, and I've seen the worst in Joel Rifkin.
The Rifkin house was on Paul's route when he was a meter reader back in the early 90s. And he had frequent encounters with the members of the household.
I would have to say it was 1991 or 92. I was about 29 years old when I started. Well, as a meter reader, you get a route and you go from house to house. In people's yards, and you get to know people and meet people. Joel Rifkin's mom, she used to come out once in a while, say hello. She was a nice lady, very nice neighborhood, middle class, typical middle class neighborhood, East Meadow. And on this one given day, I remember having that particular route, and Joel was a landscaper by trade, and he happened to be outside that day raking. Very strange looking character. I remember distinctly walking past, he had a big trailer, landscaping trailer, and I remember walking by it and the odor coming from it. It was an instant gag reflex. You know, I've been in butcher shops and stuff like that where they have, which smells really bad too. Believe me, this was something of a different nature. My eyes were tearing, and I didn't think anything of it, but you remember things like that distinctly. I've never seen or encountered a rotting body, but I know I had to smell it, that's for sure.
So during this encounter, Paul came face to face with Joel Rifkin himself.
Very awkward looking, you know, glasses. But I remember his stare. He stared at me when I was walking by, because when I'm telling you, that day he was out and I walked past that landscape trailer, I was like, oh my God. And I remember looking back and him staring and a strange interaction, but I just kept going. You know, you think, oh, what a weirdo, you know, strange glance back at him, and he definitely, you know, he was a strange-looking character.
So we asked Paul about when this encounter, which was seemingly inconsequential, turned into something extremely significant, and how this was all coming together for him, and the dots were being connected.
When he was arrested and they said that they found body parts in his landscaping trailer. And I said, no way. That is the time I put it all together, because you don't tear up and have a gag reflex from grass or, you know, typical clippings. Yeah, it can smell, but not the way this smelled. When that news report came out, that's when I put it together. Awful. awful. It was, you know, I've told this story to other people, and you know, recently someone said to me, hey, it's too bad they knew I was going to do this little interview here. And they said, it's too bad you didn't call the cops. And I said, yeah, you know, I said, come to think of it, being that it was such an odd smell, you know, maybe it could have prevented things. But, you know, obviously, hindsight, and I didn't know what that smell was. Putting it together, yeah, it all makes sense.
After the arrest of Rifkin, the police went to the home he shared with his mother. When the police arrived, they told her that her son had been, quote, involved in a traffic violation, but that he was okay.
Now, the only thing stranger that I can think of, beyond maybe being somebody who is reading the meter at the Rifkin house and smelt one of his victims decomposing in the summer heat, would be also if you were that same meter reader who randomly ended up also working at one of the homes of the victims of the same serial killer. And that is what happened here.
And there is some irony to this whole story, too. And as I said, as a meter reader, you go to a lot of people's homes. And one of the unfortunate things is when I transferred to Suffolk County, I happened to read the home of one of his victims, and that really struck a nerve. You know, it really hit, I just, you know, strange feeling. When I transferred to Suffolk County, you know, you become friends with coworkers and everything, and, you know, we talked about the Rifkin case came up in the office because, you know, I talked about it because I read his home, you know. I saw him, I saw what he looked like up close, and, you know, it's strange because one of my coworkers was friends with one of the victims, and he had said where she lived. I believe it was the M section of Stony Brook, not too far from where you grew up. Oh, yeah, he was upset. He was like, she was such a nice girl. It's just unbelievable.
In part two of our Joel Rifkin episode, we are going to unpack what you just heard. And we are going to talk about the victim in Stony Brook, the one Paul ended up at the home of. And there is a lot more to come. And this just gets stranger and more bizarre by the minute. So let this episode be a constant reminder to all of you that we are all more connected than we realize, even if it's merely via our utility companies.
And not only that, there are a ton of first degree connections that we want to deal with. There's a lot of pop culture references to this case. There's also a lot of things that myself and Alexis, who both grew up and lived on Long Island, which is where Rifkin, the most prolific serial killer in New York State history, was from, had to deal with. So there's a lot more coming in part two. What have we learned today?
What did we learn today? I think that we learned that.
I mean, I think my biggest and most basic takeaway from today's episode is that just because you're bullied doesn't mean you need to become a monster and doesn't justify your terrible actions.
Yes. I've been bullied before. I mean, baseball camp? Seriously. Oh my God. I can't tell you how bad baseball camp was.
I could totally see Billy
no,
being
that's a whole other book.
Just the tallest guy there gosh. Being battered by like a group of little
like,
kids.
No, go
tallest guy with glasses.
Oh my God. You're like virgin.
I think I learned.
I'm a virgin. I'm 13.
I hope you're a virgin.
No, I think I learned something. I think what's interesting in that it cannot go ignored. And I feel like in some serial killer cases, they really punctuate this sort of thing, but it hasn't been as much so as in the Rifkin case. But he was adopted. Mm-hmm. And they talk about Bundy all the time, where his mother was told, his mother was his aunt.
Yeah.
And whatever. But I think the adoption is really big here, because even the fact that there was also something I read that said he was told that he was adopted at 11.
I mean, Berkowitz is adopted too, so.
But there is also a billion people that are, but there are millions of people that are adopted that also did not turn into monsters.
I'm just saying, people don't talk about it with Rifkin, because there is something to it. I mean, I just saw in interviews later that they were like, he started to do a lot of research, frontal lobe research, things about his brain, had brain scans done. It became like something he was fascinated by.
But I can see that only. But the thing is, his adopted parents seemingly were very loving parents, and he had a pretty good childhood, minus when the bullying started. So unless he's trying, it was one of those things that he's like, oh, I just can't be the man that my dad always wanted me to be because I'm not genetically, you know, whatever. Yeah, if that's the thing, then maybe, but I don't know. Seems like a cop-out to be like, well, we was adopted. Okay, so part two of Joel Rifkin is coming next week, but until then, we're still looking for a name for our listeners. And we made a little post about it in our Facebook group, which, by the way, if you guys aren't a part of, go join it. Search The First Degree on Facebook. There's lots of true crime chatter happening in there. But Billy is not on board for the owls for our OG superfans. But I think, because he says it's too much of a deep cut, but isn't that the reason why you have superfans? Because they love the deep cuts? I still have a couple more names that I want to throw out on the podcast. Right.
Oh. What are they?
Amber said that we should be called the Van Gen Setters.
That was my favorite. Van Gen Setters.
Okay. It's never going to happen, but it was good.
And Van Gen Setters is
then
great.
April said that we should be called the Hot Links. Hot for degrees and looks, and links for connections. Plus, Hot Links are delicious.
And I responded and I said, I think
that's a great.
I think Hot Links are good.
I think that we're close. I think we're like sussing it out.
I saw something about the alibis.
Alibis are good too.
But it has nothing like, you know, you usually want something to like
the hot links.
Connected
hot
to
links
the
is,
actual
hot
name
hot
of the podcast.
Hot Links is cute.
Hot but Links
the,
is
yeah,
cute.
Yeah, the Degreers I saw.
The Degreers is kind of cool.
Hot Links.
We're going to think about that one.
Just it's like a cute little hot dog emoji. Like, think about that.
It is pretty cute. All right. Well, until next week, if you guys are connected to a murder or other Stranger Than Fiction crime, please write us hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com, @AlexisLinkletter, @BillyJensen, @JackVanek. Please follow us on Instagram. We just hit 10,100 followers @thefirstdegree. And until next week, only you can prevent serial killers.
No.
But only you can prevent serial killers.
No.
It's a Rifkin episode.
So until next week.
Only you can prevent serial killers.
And remember to keep your friends close.
But not that close. This episode quotes Maria F. Timaeus's book, Garden of Grapes, Robert Mladenich from The Mouth of the Monster, Jack Rosewood's book, Joel Rifkin, The Horrifying and True Story of Joel the Ripper, and articles written by Helen Peterson, Tony Rogers, Corky Seismatsko, Mike McEllery, and Simone Weichenblum for the New York Daily News, and for the New York Times, Diana Jean Shimo and John T. McQuiston, as well as the Encyclopedia of Serial Killers, and Maria Efetimatis' article for The People, The Quiet Man.